Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were talking about the problems of public health, of overcrowding in early 19th century towns. And I want to go on by talking about some of the other aspects of it, the care for the poor, and also the build-up of political pressure. And let's start with something that, you know, a lot of people often talk very emotively about, which is the workhouse. And I can think, for example, Jeremy Paxman having a tear to his eye when he realised one of his ancestors had been in a workhouse. Certainly, there were issues with the care of the poor under the 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act, with many workhouses harsh as well as bleak. To give, for example, Wimborne, the workhouse beds had to be shared. Meat was only provided once a week. There were no vegetables other than potatoes until 1849. Men and women were segregated, and unmarried mothers had to wear distinctive clothes. The Andover workhouse scandal of 1845 revealed an abusive and corrupt master of the workhouse and totally inadequate rations, something that would have been very suited to a Dickens novel. In Stroud workhouse in 1849, cruelty encompassed a scalding to death. I think it's worth saying, though, that there were problems with the workhouse system. I think it's worth saying there were problems with the pre-workhouse system, with what was known as outdoor relief, people being helped in their homes. And I think it's also worth saying that the problems of workhouse care in the 19th century it doesn't make them any easier to point out there are many abuses of care in the present world. But I think one needs to bear in mind that that is a context within which possibly one should see the issue. Urban responses, indeed, renewal of poor workhouses, like everything else, were political, not least because of the costs entailed and the patronage involved. So, for example, in Nottingham, there was delay in building a large modern workhouse, as stipulated by the Poor Law of 1834, because the Tories, who were prominent in Nottingham, preferred the previous system of outdoor relief, people being looked after in their homes. And the new workhouse was not completed until 1843. One has to be aware that what the workhouse was seen as progress. That doesn't mean inherently that progress is free of problems, nor that there wasn't a political dimension to that debate. And again, one can think about social welfare in Britain over the last, healthcare in Britain over the last 100 years, and realise that exactly the same is true. And now, obviously, people aren't always sure that institutionalisation is necessarily good or necessarily bad. Towns more directly engaged political concern due to their being centres of political stress. For example, as the sources of press criticism, the towns led the opposition to the Tory establishment in the early 19th century, the period of the Earl of Liverpool's administration in particular. Town politics, including, for example, the voting of official thanks, as in 1809, when Salisbury Corporation voted thanks to the parliamentary denouncers who were in the opposition of the sale of army commissions by the mistress of Frederick, Duke of York, the head of the army. In the provinces, the demand for peace with Napoleon, another opposition cause, was led by the Leeds Mercury under its editor-proprietor, Edward Baines. And most of the 11 individuals who funded his acquisition of the paper in 1801 were dissenters. Newspapers which supported this opposition call, included the Nottingham Review, founded in 1808 by a Methodist printer, Charles Sutton, and the West Briton, launched in 1810. Other papers critical of the wartime government included the Leicester Chronicle, the Liverpool Mercury, and the Manchester Evening Herald. Rates of reading and writing, and thus ready access to the print, were higher in town than countryside due to the differences in schooling. So, for example, by 1811, Warwick had a grammar school, a borough school, free schools, a school of industry, which was effectively a poor law school for pauper children and orphans, and denominational Sunday schools, and all that for a relatively small town, though it ought to be mentioned that the schools themselves were not large. The end of the Napoleonic War in 1815 saw a continuance of opposition press activism focused on towns, including, for example, in the newly launched Sheffield Independent of 1819 and the Manchester Guardian of 1821. In this and other respects, moral improvement gained a pointedly political content and energy, and at both the local and the national levels. There was also an important economic dimension with worker opposition to new technology. So, for example, in 1812, the Luddite riots saw extensive attacks on factory equipment in the North and the Midlands. At a general meeting on the 27th of February 1812 in Huddersfield, a major Yorkshire centre of the woolen industry, a subscription association hostile to the Luddites was established in order to obtain information about the riots. And the resolutions accepted an account that was scarcely one of calm. And this is worth thinking about if you are inclined to characterise society of that period by Jane Austen novels. Quote, "It appears to this meeting that a violent and determined spirit of insubordination has gained much ground amongst the workmen employed in various trades and manufactures, and particularly amongst the shearmen, and that the same is organised and supported in a manner not only alarming to trade in general, but to the peaceable inhabitants of this town and neighbourhood in particular. That we cannot sufficiently deprecate all attempts to limit the ingenuity of our artificers, the employment of our capital, and to prescribe the mode to which the different operations of our trade shall be conducted, and particularly those now making in this neighbourhood for the destruction of the machinery used in the finishing of woolen cloth." In other words, these were people particularly associated with the industrial activity in Huddersfield, who were opposed to the Luddites. And one might inquire, of course, in a different context, whether, for example, you know, you will have your own views, environmental activists in the present day might be viewed in the same light, in the sense that their attitudes and actions might also imperil economic activity. Nottingham, a centre of Luddism, saw a more general radicalism, including opposition to the Corn Law, and in 1815 to renewed war with Napoleon. Subsequently, urban tension and reform demands led to the brutal governmental response that caused the so-called Peterloo Massacre of 1819 in Manchester, while in London, the very differently radical Cato Street conspiracy was suppressed the following year. Peterloo Massacre, of course, being the use of the yeomanry in a brutal and deeply flawed attempt to end a demonstration. I think it's worth saying that demonstrations always, urban demonstrations always, are a major problem for the forces of law and order. There was to be fresh violence in the early 1830s with major riots in Bristol, Derby and Nottingham in 1831 as part of the pressure for a reformed electoral system. Henry, 4th Duke of Newcastle, a politically active ultra-Tory, very much sought to direct constituencies in which he had an influence, evicting tenants for openly supporting an opposition candidate at the Newark by-election in 1829, stating he should be able to do, quote, what I will with my own. This was a view that no longer, I think it's fair to say, really worked in the urban environment. The following year, the Duke of Newcastle noted during the 1830 general election that he would, quote, place in the House of Commons five of its cleverest members. In contrast, in Newcastle under Lyme, the interests of the nearby Leveson Gowers, as well as of the self-elected corporation, were both challenged and weakened by social change and voter politicisation. More generally, broadsides and other propaganda emphasise the role of ordinary citizens. And it's worth saying that a lot of opposition activism focused on printing, which was far less expensive than the classic means of electoral control in terms of treating the electors, buying them all drinks. In the event, the Reform Act of 1832, passed by the Whig administration, saw growing towns such as Birmingham, Blackburn, Bolton, Bradford, Leeds, Manchester, Oldham, Sheffield, South Shields and Sunderland, all of course in the Midlands or the North, that had not hitherto had their own MPs, gain separate representation from the county seats. It is absurd, as sometimes said, that their voters did not previously have the vote. They did have the vote, but in the county seats. Now they had their own separate seats. 22 large towns gained 2 MPs and 19 English towns gained 1. In contrast, many so-called rotten boroughs, seats with small populations, such as Minehead, a seat under the control of the Luttrells of nearby Dunster Castle, and Old Sarum, lost separate representation. That led to the loss of many separate seats in the South, notably in Cornwall, where localism had been particularly evident in small boroughs and helped by the major advantage for local candidates, political practices and alignments were of considerable durability. 56 boroughs lost their seats and 30 lost 1 of their 2 MPs. You would not be surprised to hear, and again, before you start thinking, gosh, this is awful, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there's been gerrymandering in British constituency drawing in the present day. You won't be surprised to hear that political favouritism played a role in the 1832 legislation. As with Stockton, there the Tory Marquess of Londonderry was influential, so it remained without its own MPs because the Whigs were now drawing up representation, whereas Whig strongholds in County Durham, in contrast, gained seats. The Municipal Corporations Act of 1835, again passed by the Whig government, standardised the situation for the government of municipal corporations, replacing self-selecting oligarchic corporations, mostly run by Tories, in the 178 towns where such corporations had been dominant. And these were replaced by elected borough councils based on a franchise of rated occupiers. These had control over the local police, over markets, over street lighting. The creation, indeed, of police forces in London in 1829 and in provincial towns in the 1830s and 40s reflected anxiety about urban crime, a sense that something had to be done and could be achieved, as well as towns copying each other and competing with each other. This Municipal Corporations Act was to be the basis of an upsurge in urban politics and a wave of urban reformism that drew on a continuity of commitment on the part of many. For example, the self-made Mancunian, for the benefit of Americans, a Mancunian is an inhabitant of Manchester, Absalom Watkin, they all have marvellous names, a critic of Peterloo, a supporter of the Reform Act and the Anti-Corn Law League, and a proponent of undenominational state education, in other words, getting rid of the influence of the Church of England in schools. Such individuals tended to be found in towns. More generally, the political content of local government was transformed as the vote became a way to ensure participation. To a degree, this helped align local with national politics, with the latter and the resulting alignments coming to dominate the former in most towns, for example, Shaftesbury. A sense of public accountability was captured in a paper I was looking at, the Sherborne Mercury of the 6th of February 1837, under the heading Reform Meeting at Lyme Regis. So Lyme Regis and Sherborne, both in the county of Dorset, as indeed is Shaftesbury. Quote, A public meeting was held in the Guildhall, the mayor in the chair, for the purpose of enabling their respected representative, William Pinney, Esq., to state his opinions upon the leading political questions of the day and to take the sense of his constituents on his parliamentary conduct during the past session, very much public politics. This article continued by providing details of the meeting. It's worth bearing in mind that elected MP in 1832, Pinney as a Whig, was unseated in turn in 1842 for bribery. In other words, people might go to public meetings, but that doesn't mean that they weren't crooked. You needed to be pretty crooked to be unseated for bribery, as indeed is the case today, I notice. I wonder how much one should congratulate the Prime Minister on having his clothes and glasses bought for him. But apparently that does not these days constitute bribery. Now, aside from the specifics of political pressure, the press was more generally a support for so-called improvement. Improvement as understood by those who wanted reform and stability on their own terms, reform more particularly as perceived by those with wealth and property. For example, the Birmingham Commercial Herald of the 16th of January 1804 supported the local plan for an association to protect the property of the honest and industrious, laid out in an advertisement for, quote, a society for preventing, detecting and punishing fraudulent bankrupts, swindlers, etc. Yet improvement also involved criticism, notably of vested interests, as in the Birmingham Chronicle of 11th of March 1824, which under the headline The Free Grammar School of Birmingham declared, quote, a considerable interest having been excited in the town relative to an intended application to Parliament for enlarging the objects and appropriating the funds of this noble and invaluable institution, and several correspondents having addressed letters to our journal on the supposed intentions and object of the governors, we have been at some pains and expense to procure correct and entire copies of the charters and documents of its original foundation and present government. We now place them collectively before our readers, certain that publicity is the best guarantee of integrity in public trusts, and that the executive management of the school can have no objection to a free statement of their powers and the objects of the trust. Some deference is due to public opinion. And that, of course, was an argument repeatedly and more frequently being made in the urban context. On the 13th of May, that paper went on to call for an annual statement of receipts and expenditure from the school. Similarly, John Edward Taylor, the founder of the Manchester Guardian, was subsequently deputy chairman of the Improvement Committee of the Manchester Commissioners of Police. His colleague Jeremiah Garnett was one of the commissioners. In Preston, gaslighting based on Wigan coal, in other words, local coal, and supported by the Preston Chronicle and local capital, local investment, was introduced early and also, of course, helped the cotton manufacturers by lighting their mills in the winter. So if you want, you can take a Marxist interpretation as well as a liberal reforming interpretation. Social pressure arising from economic change became more acute in the 1840s, focused on the Chartist movement. However, it didn't lead to a political crisis. Moreover, the elite's engagement with new developments was seen with the visit of Prince Albert, the reforming husband of Queen Victoria, to Birmingham in 1843, in an affirmation of a link between monarchy, industry, and modernity. Due to radical agitation, Albert had been advised not to visit Birmingham. It's worth bearing in mind that people these days sometimes say that the monarchy is, you know, out of touch, finished, all the rest of it. It's worth bearing in mind that there were grave pressures affecting the monarchy in the 19th century and indeed six attempts to assassinate Queen Victoria. Anyway, Albert did go to Birmingham, toured five major factories and was favourably received. Improvement, indeed, became a national policy. In 1848, the Public Health Act created a structure, including local boards of health, to improve sanitation, and they took action. So the Board of Health, established in Leicester in 1849, was instrumental in the creation of a sewerage system and in tackling slaughterhouses and smoke pollution. A critical report on Derby by Edward Cressy, a superintending inspector under the General Board of Health, led the council to embark on a programme of works, including public baths and washhouses. And of course, it's worth bearing in mind that public baths and wash houses were very common until several decades ago. Contemporaries were also concerned about the religious situation. The expansion of towns stretched existing church provision, while the mission of the churches did not necessarily elicit a response, i.e. not everybody was interested in evangelicals straining their sinews in the cause of the improvement of others. The religious census of 1851, the only religious census taken in that century, revealed, for example, that in the growing Suffolk towns of Ipswich and Mildenhall, there was only sufficient space in Anglican churches for a minority of parishioners, a widespread problem. Larger parishes were those where Anglican devotion was less apparent in Suffolk, and personal circumstances were important. So John Davis, the Anglican rector of St Clement's Worcester, reported that his working-class parishioners, quote, seldom ever attend Sunday morning service. The Saturday market and the late payment of wages on the evening of that day contribute probably in no small degree to produce this. Well, what that means, what that quote means, is as follows. Drink keeps devotion at bay. That's what he's saying. And that, of course, contributed to the temperance movement that became stronger in the second half of the century. Moreover, however, urbanisation could stimulate not just declining church attendances, but also active anti-clericalism. Towns also saw tensions between churches to the fore, not least due to the re-establishment of the Catholic hierarchy in 1850 and anxiety about massive Irish immigration as a result of the Great Irish Famine of 1845 to 51. Despite efforts by the poor law authorities to return Irish migrants to Ireland, there was a substantial change to many towns as well as to the image of urban life. Hostility to Catholics was seen at the level of particular towns, for example, the Murphy riots in 1867 in Birmingham, but also more generally. To many, this was an important element in urban culture. Indeed, this hostility to Catholics was one of the factors that helped to define urban politics and in a way that looked forward into the 20th century. Urban conservatism, in particular, was in part a matter of anti-Catholicism, as well as being opposed to dissenters and their commitment to temperance. Conservatives tended to be the party of drink. Such a definition, however, fails to capture variations between and within particular towns, the within attracting far less attention than the between. Yet at the same time as these variations, there was a degree of nationalisation of politics linked to national political parties and movements, so, for example, the Primrose League of the Conservatives. This nationalisation was criticised as sapping urban identities and replacing the cohesion of particular towns by partisanship, but that was a long-standing argument rather than one simply of the period. Indeed, the difference was not so much a degree of division, but rather the extent to which national labels were willingly embraced by those who were thus divided. So people who had a difference for possibly other reasons in alignment were quite happy to declare themselves as Whig and Tory, or subsequently Conservative and Liberal. This also meant a potential degree of subordination on the part of specific urban identities. On the one hand, there was a long-standing ability to deploy and retain multiple identities, both involving urban life and encompassing other concerns. But such an ability did not mean that these identities were of unchanging relative weight. Here, indeed, there appears to have been significant change in the late 19th century, one that was in part linked to specific administrative changes related to the establishment of county councils. And this scarcely exhausted the disruptive developments affecting towns. So, for example, the provision of education changed at a greater rate than since the Reformation. Church building involved a lot of disputes, where the churches should be, who should be appointed. Railways created some new alignments, both between and within towns, while some existing ones disappeared. Again, change was in part a matter of the churn of the generations, because individuals maintained experiences, values, and hopes in part grounded in their life cycle. As a result, there was an accumulative character to modernity, an idea itself that was contested, and many of the changes of the late 19th century were fully felt only in the 20th. This lapsed character, one we see today as well, to the urban experience, is less than obvious in the sources and is regarded as less prominent than the rural counterpart. It tends to be the case that most historians and commentators of the past, and indeed of the present, refer to the countryside as more conservative. Yet it's a character that's worth considering also for the town. So also with both townscape and housing stock, there was massive changes in both. These obviously attract attention, notably when space is limited in any lecture or any book, but also much that was at least a survival and often a continuation based on considerable support. And that's what an important aspect of urban life. Nevertheless, change was very much noted. So Manchester, described in 1859 by John McCulloch, quote, "Great improvements have been made within the last 30 years. Narrow lanes have been pulled down to make way for broad avenues. Noble public buildings, which would be ornamental to any capital in the world." That was followed 2 years later by a painting by William Bell Scott sent in Newcastle. Quote, the title, "In the 19th century, the Northumbrians show the world what can be done with iron and coal." And that sought to capture, as Scott stated, something of the common labour, life and applied science of the day. It depicted, the painting, heroic workers at Robert Stevenson's engineering factory, one of the largest manufacturers of railway engines in the world. It showed an Armstrong gun, also produced in Newcastle. It showed the steam of modern communications. It showed the high-level bridge, a very impressive engineering feat between the banks of the Tyne, and it showed telegraph wires. Another somewhat different view of the role of urban institutions was presented by the Reverend Harris at the annual meeting of the Darlington Horticultural Society. Quote, "This society was calculated to improve and elevate the taste of all classes, especially the poorer classes, by withdrawing them in their leisure hours from grosser indulgences to a pleasurable and improving pursuit. At the same time, and less positively, condition of England issues were very much presented in an urban context, and another cleric, the rector of Bethnal Green, was less optimistic in 1895. He reported, quote, "A vast majority of the men in your district will have spent their Sundays for the last 25 years, and their fathers before them, in the following way. They will have laid in bed till about 11 or 12, having been up early all week." That's because they've been working, of course. "They will then go round when the public house is open, which they do at 1. They will have what they call a wet till 3. A wet, it was, of course, drinking. They will then have dinner, the great dinner of the week, which the missus has been preparing all morning. Then comes a lie down on the bed in shirt sleeves until 5 with a pot of beer and Lloyd's Weekly." Lloyd's Weekly was the equivalent of the News of the World. They were very similar and full of crime stories. "Then follows tea, and after tea, a bit of a walk round to see a friend or a relation. Then fairly early to bed to make up for a very late Saturday night." Urban differentiation, however, you know, this, what he's just describing was true of Bethnal Green and was true of, you know, working class districts more generally. The middle class, of course, had different environments in which to drink. But at the same time, there was urban differentiation. It became more pronounced in the 19th century with the expansion of large towns, particularly important within a context of general growth, so that by 1901, nearly 80% of the population lived in towns with over 2,500 people. So it becomes much harder to distinguish the urban experience from national history as a whole, which indeed is the case today. Yet once England was an overwhelming urban nation, then the urban environment, its changing character, including transport, housing and planning, and the fortunes of different types of town were of even greater consequence, as indeed is also the case today. So, as with the first half of the 19th century and the second half of the 19th century, alongside the continued development of the leading town, London, there was the continuing spectacular rise of other major towns such as Manchester, Liverpool and Birmingham, and on the British scale, Glasgow. This was a rise that was of global significance, not least as British shipping dominated oceanic trade. Liverpool and London were ports of world importance, while Sunderland was by 1850 the greatest shipbuilding town in the world, with high wages and a high rate of owner occupation of housing. Industrialisation was what really brought Britain prosperity and prominence. The modern attempt to argue that it was slavery is completely ridiculous. The economic health of towns owed much to communications, which increasingly meant rail rather than canal. For example, with railways creating ready access to nearby iron ore mines and to coke supplies from Durham, four major iron and steel works were established at Workington in 1862 to 74, and the population there rose from 6,467 in 1860 to 23,749 in 1891, nearly quadrupling in 30 years. Ports tried to develop rail links in order to enhance their significance and to benefit from this industrialization of iron and coal. So Hull did that, for example. There was also specialization at other levels, as in leisure, for example, seaside resorts such as Newquay, Ramsgate, Bournemouth, Hove, Eastbourne, Margate, Southend, Yarmouth, Skegness, Cleethorpes, Bridlington, Scarborough, Whitley Bay, Morecambe and Blackpool, all of which were fed by rail and linked, you know, the workers of industrial towns. So, you know, from Nottingham, for example, off to Skegness. In contrast, spas were of declining importance. Nevertheless, despite the growth of major towns, much of the population still lived and worked in small towns, and large numbers in areas that suffered deindustrialization, such as East Anglia. So many towns there, such as, for example, Diss or Swaffham, had little growth and indeed were not to change greatly until they expanded again from the 1960s. The sustained Great Agricultural Depression that began in the 1870s, in part due to the import of Australasian meat, North American grain and Argentinian beef, hit such towns hard, as did an integration of the country through the intensification of the rail network, which meant that functions hitherto supplied very locally could be obtained from a distance. But at the same time, many towns that are not now seen as manufacturing centres were important then for industry. So, for example, Tewkesbury. There was the mechanised manufacturing of stockings at Messrs Owen and Uglow's factory at Tewkesbury. Owen invented and patented the reinforcing of the underfoot and heels of stockings, and his factory employed 600 workmen and 150 women. Tewkesbury was served by river and from 1840 by rail. Industrial centres, I think it's fair to say, tended to be less conservative in political and religious terms than other towns, than, for example, county capitals. So Luton, which specialised in the making of straw hats, had a strong nonconformist element and was also a centre of liberalism. At a different scale, the painting of about 1871 by the North Shields born Miles Birkett Foster, Newcastle upon Tyne from Windmill Hill, Gateshead, showed formerly prominent buildings, the car of Newcastle, the castle keep and the cathedral, now joined by factory chimneys and the railway bridge. As yet, there was not the prospects that were to be obtained from skyscrapers. So in many senses, it was factory chimneys that were the new highest points. Newcastle's population rose from 28,294 in 1801 to 215,328 in 1901, And such an increase was only achieved by large-scale migration, much of it people with scant experience of towns. Of course, when I'm talking about migration into Newcastle, I'm not meaning from abroad. I'm meaning essentially from within Britain. So also elsewhere. So, for example, at the Britannia Foundry in Derby in 1871, had 225 iron workers. Over half were born outside Derby, but most came from Derbyshire, and this pattern of migration from nearby was more generally the case. Yet there was also migration from a greater distance, although far from on the scale of the situation today. The 1851 census revealed that 18.9% of Liverpool's population was Irish-born, largely a response to the recent potato blight and resulting famine in Ireland. And of course, Liverpool was also the major town closest to Ireland. Other port cities, such as Portsmouth and Plymouth, also had many migrants. Overwhelmingly poor and attractive as labour precisely because they were paid badly, the Irish migrants lived in the areas of cheapest rent, which were invariably the most crowded and the least sanitary. So in Newcastle, where the percentage of Irish-born migrants rose to 8 in 1851, the majority of them were housed in poor living conditions in areas such as Sandgate. The men in Newcastle were generally employed as labourers or in other casual work, the women as washerwomen, flower sellers, or other poorly paid jobs. The migrants focused and exacerbated anti-Catholic feeling, to which Irish violence contributed, not least in Liverpool, in Middlesbrough, and in Wolverhampton. However, as a reminder of the perennial variety, many Irish immigrants did not live in ghettos, but were dispersed across working class areas, and a certain number married out. Others emerged into the middle class. Population density continued to grow in many cities, ensuring serious overcrowding. Somber statistics hinted at the human suffering that accompanied in Liverpool the massive growth in trade. So in 1846, Liverpool contained 538 brothels, and in 1857, there were at least 200 regular prostitutes under the age of 12 there. At the same time, the wealth of Liverpool resulted in new residential park suburbs, such as Prince's Park in 1842, and many fine public buildings. This was in particular prior to the major expansion of rail-linked suburbs, an expansion that required available finance and land. Squalor also led to Liverpool becoming one of the first places anywhere to embark on a programme of municipal house building. Now, this became easier because of the agricultural depression that began in 1873, because land became cheaper. And that was an aspect of the purchase of the close relationship, between landed interests and towns. Now, at the present moment, the situation is very different. Any plan for the kind of building which the new government wishes to envisage actually is going to be affected by the cost of land. There was development within towns themselves by aristocratic landowners, such as the Earls of Darlington in Bath, Lord Calthorpe at Edgbaston in Birmingham, the Dukes of Devonshire at Eastbourne. A critical stance was adopted by George Bernard Shaw in his play Widowers' Houses in 1892, with the aristocratic Henry Trench appalled that Blanche Sartorius's father is wealthy through slum landlordism, only for Sartorius to point out that Trench's money has come from similar sources. Indeed, the Marquess of Salisbury owned a lot of London slum property. So I'll close at that point at the moment because it helps to capture some of the interesting aspects of the relationship between landed interests and towns. It's worth saying that agricultural depression not only encouraged aristocratic landowners to develop their urban properties, but also helped to encourage rural depopulation and therefore the move into the cities, the internal migration which I've been referring to. Graham, I think we could pause there at the moment.
Yes, we can indeed. Do you have time to take a quick question?
Yes, I certainly do, yeah.
Thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I just wanted to ask, and it goes back to what you're saying in earlier parts of your talk, which is about the nature of the 1832 Reform Act and how that affected the politics, the representation of towns in England more generally. Are we seeing any difference between towns after 1832, towns returning different political structures to their corporations, to their corporate government, than to their MPs? Or generally, if a corporation is Whig, the MPs being returned to Westminster are Whig or Tory and vice versa?
Yes, I think the latter is a fair account. I think it's worth saying that obviously there's a lot of plasticity in the 1840s and 50s. I mean, the late Angus Hawkins wrote wonderfully about that period. And, you know, the transition from Whigs to Whigs to Liberals and from Tories to Conservatives is interplayed with things like the tension over the Corn Law repeal and the way in which that produces rivalries, in fact, a breakdown within the Tory party. And therefore, I think, and of course, subsequently, ones to have a breakdown within the Liberal Party over Irish Home Rule. So I think it's fair to say, although other issues also play a role, so I think it's fair to say you're absolutely right, but it's worth also drawing attention to the fact that there is more than just a simple dichotomy. And what that means is that in any, say, municipal or local politics, or constituency, or what we would call a constituency sort of activists, there may well be differing tensions and rivalries that are more acute than those with people of a different political label.
Yes, I could that I could well believe. The one other aspect I wanted to pick up on, you mentioned Sunderland being the world's largest shipbuilding centre and the quite significant level of home ownership in Sunderland at that time. How unusual is that? I mean, the assumption is always the industrialised towns are growing rapidly. People are moving from particularly the surrounding countryside and to less prosperous towns into these industrialising towns and cities. And they're going into cheap rented accommodation. Is that the case in the other towns, what we might call the second order towns, or do you actually have towns which are more stable in their population? Is there a greater tendency towards home ownership?
Well, home ownership tends to come with money. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that average real wages rise in the 1850s and 60s. It's one of the things that leads Chartism to go nowhere. And, you know, the economic boom of industrialization brings prosperity. And that can be seen in modern English towns with what we would call the traditional terraced house, which was very much becoming more common. I mean, prior to that, there had been, for poorer people, the sort of, you know, back-to-backs, lodging houses, damp cellars in which all too many lived. These are increasingly can be replaced by purpose-built houses by developers, many of them very small, the developers, but some of them, you know, bigger in scale, using in particular brick, and of course kept warm by coal fires. And all of those offer a quality of life. Now, look, by modern standards, people's life expectancy was nowhere near what it is now. But on the other hand, if you were in work and had a good job, and one must remember there was no such thing as the working class, there were working classes, as it were. If you had a good job, you were well off. And of course, the same thing is true today. I mean, you know, if you're a locomotive driver, you can afford to, you know, have a very lavish style of living. Whereas obviously there are sort of working, and you can still call yourself working class and go to the trade union congress and all the rest of it. Whereas there are obviously working class jobs that are considerably more parlous.
Indeed, there are. Podcast hosting is not one of them. But thank you very much indeed, Jeremy Black. Fascinating period of transition in the history of English towns you were discussing today. And we look forward to more next week. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.